Mexico, and welcome to the Santa Fe Radio Cafe. My name is Mary Charlotte. We're broadcasting live from the Santa Fe Bacon Company on Cordova Road and streaming on the web at ksfr.org. We're also podcasting. The website is santaferadiocafe.org, where you can listen to the show anytime you want, thanks to Santa Fe's .foil computer services. And you can also subscribe to the show on iTunes. I'd like to welcome now Tutu Alicante. He's a visiting research associate at the School for Advanced Research here in Santa Fe. He's a human rights attorney from Equatorial Guinea, and he's affiliated with the Southern Migrant Law Center and Columbia University's Project for Human Rights in Africa and the Americas. Welcome.
Thank you very much, Mayor Charlotte.
It's wonderful to have you here. Let's talk, first of all, about your country, Equatorial Guinea. I suspect that at least some of our listeners do not know where it is on the map. It's on the west coast of Africa. Tell us more.
Yes, it's on the west coast of Africa, and it's between Cameroon and Gabon. So Equatorial Guinea, because it's very close to the equator. You know, part of the country are above the equator, and part is under the equator. So, for instance, Anobon, the island that I'm from, is in the southern hemisphere. Closer to Gabon than, say, the rest of Equatorial Guinea, while Bioko Island, where the capital is closer to Cameroon, and the rest, the continental part, sectioned between Cameroon and Gabon.
And so this is a very small country with about a 500,000 people population, landmass the size of Maryland, but it's also it has a continental part and a number of islands.
Yes, yes. And actually, I should say that most of the time whenever I'm telling people they don't know where Equatorial Guinea is about Equatorial Guinea, I start out by telling them where Equatorial Guinea is not. Because in Africa, you have two additional Guineas. You have Guinea-Conakry, where they speak French. You have Guinea-Bissau, where they speak Portuguese. And you have New Guinea, which is in Australian deals. So I start telling people that because later on what happens, you know, is after telling them I'm from Equatorial Guinea, then they say, oh, Equatorial New Guinea, and there's no such place.
That's right. And it's also, well, tell us a little bit about the history of the country and the history of colonization, because it's one of the few Spanish-speaking colonies, former colonies in Africa.
Exactly. It's actually the only Spanish colony in sub-Saharan Africa. Initially, it started out as a possession of Portugal. So Portugal, in the 1470s, actually running slaves from Angola and other places in Africa to Brazil, ran into these territories, São Tomé and Príncipe, the country that's São Tomé and Príncipe today, and Anobon, and eventually Bioko and the rest of Equatorial Guinea. And for almost 500 years, where Portuguese used the territory, they didn't claim it really as a colony. They just used it for different reasons. Then around 1757 or so, they traded territories with Spain, where Spain got some of the territories in Africa, in the Equatorial Africa, while Portugal got some of Spanish territories around Brazil, in and around Brazil.
So this is a country that's tropical with rainforests and mountains and farmland. Tell us a little bit more about just the look and feel of the country.
Well, it's a beautiful country by all accounts. It's very lush. It's very green. Part of being in that part of Africa, in the equator, where you don't have winters and you don't have seasons, you just have rainy seasons and dry season, is that, you know, you tend to have a lot of vegetation. So is the flora, the fauna, the climate are, in my opinion, you know, very, very appropriate. It's Malabo, the capital city, is on the island of Bioko, and it's a beautiful island, beautiful beaches and everything. Sadly for us right now, oil development and other things happening are eroding the beauty of the nation, and also the fact that, for instance, on the continental side, there's been a lot of the timber industry, there's been a lot of tree cutting. So right now, the climate is beginning little by little to erode, but it is still a beautiful country.
Let's talk about the history of the country up until 1968. Mm-hmm. That's a fairly recent date that the country gained its independence. How did the movement for independence happen? What was happening up until then, earlier in the 20th century?
Yeah, so for almost 200 years, it was a possession, eventually it became a colony, formal colony, then it became a province, during a period which Spain, 3 years period which Spain called emancipation period, then it became independent in 68. During the first period, you know, so before it became a former colony, Spain just intended to use the properties as slave trading purposes. Around 1950s, they found that they could actually produce cocoa and coffee and other agricultural products in their territories in the equatorial Africa. So they started using it primarily for those purposes, agriculture, timber, etc., etc. And during that period, the conditions for people living in the country were obviously very bad because they were working really under slavery conditions, you know. There were absolutely no benefits to the people working in the agricultural industry, and the discrimination and everything that's happened in the country, you know, was very, very bad. It wasn't until almost 100 years before we gained independence where Spain started introducing education as part of their being in Equatorial Guinea. Roughly around mid-1950s, when most of the African countries started discussing independence or struggling for independence, eventually in 1958 with Ghana and other nations, you know, acquiring independence, people inside Equatorial Guinea, they had gotten exposure to independent struggles in Nigeria, in Ghana, in other places, started also agitating inside the country, you know, started to demand that, you know, we needed a different system here, one that respected the people, one where people working in the agricultural industry, people who were doing all these manual jobs, could benefit from this system. So, and one of the things that helped a lot, you know, was the fact that the Equatorial Guineans, they were then struggling for independence, were able to establish international links, including at the United Nations, where eventually the United Nations and other countries started pressuring, putting pressure on Spain to take seriously the struggles and the demands for independence in Equatorial Guinea. So, we get independence in 68. 3 years before that, you know, in 65, Spain decided he was going to make turn Equatorial Guinea into a province of Spain. And what that meant, you know, is that some people, mostly the people they own lands, mostly the people they own a business inside the country, and mostly the people they had some education, were then considered emancipated, you know. And they had some certain rights, you know, they could hold some positions in certain offices in government. They could work in hospitals alongside white nurses from Spain. They could teach in some schools alongside teachers from Spain, etc., etc.
Up until that, they had no rights at all?
Up until that, no. Up until that, they have no rights at all. The schools, the hospitals, and everything else that the Spanish people ran in the country were ran by Catholic priests, Catholic nuns, and the Spanish administration. You know, so during that, and a lot of the people, actually, I should say, that started the struggle for independence were seminarians, people, mostly men, who had spent time in Catholic seminaries, hoping to become Catholic priests. And you know, one of the things that at that point, and to some extent, still today, the Catholic Church teaches in some places, is the whole notion, the concept of social justice. You know, so somehow from that effort of nurturing a priest came the, for me, fortunate event of nurturing freedom fighters and independence fighters.
Probably not what the Spanish intended.
No, definitely not. Because, in fact, most of the seminarians, you know, as soon as they started talking about independence and trying to challenge the status quo, most of them were kicked out of the seminary. Not a single one of them became a priest.
Very interesting. We're talking to Tutu Alicante from Equatorial Guinea. So then the first leader of the country after independence was Francisco Macias Nguema, and he led actually a pretty brutal regime.
Yes. Well, I should tell you first, Francisco Macias Nguema came to power in a very strange way. You know, during the colonial time, he was a translator for the Spanish administration in the continental region. Francisco Macias is a Fang. Fang are the people from the continental side. So you have seven ethnic groups, the Fang. You have the Bubis, who are mostly in the island, in the Bioko Island. You have the Criollos, who are also on the Bioko Island. On the continental side, on the around the beaches, you have a group called Playeros. You know, and there are mostly four different ethnic groups, actually. You have the Combe, the Bujeva, the Bisio, and the Bengas.
So you have a lot of languages.
Yes, we have autochthonous languages. We have seven autochthonous languages. But yeah, so Francisco Macias, going back to him, Macias came to power after translating for the Spanish and gaining the trust of the Spanish, and the Spanish seeing that this was a man that didn't have much formal education, and this was a man that they could manipulate should they grant the colony independence, they figured we should do whatever it takes to put this man in charge. Because it is true that at the point where we gained independence, there were other politicians or there were other people that could have taken over the reins of the country and done a better job. But that was not what the Spanish people wanted, what the Spanish administration, rather, wanted. You know. So instead, after manipulating the elections and doing everything they did, we ended up with Francisco Macias as the first, quote-unquote, elected president of Equatorial Guinea.
And so were those elections observed by anybody at that time?
No. This was, again, 1968, and no. The truth is no.
And so Francisco Macias came to power in a not very honest way. What happened next?
So he takes power in on the day we granted independence, and that's October 12th, 1968. And by March of 1969, he had already managed to find reasons to kick all the Spanish, all the people in the Spanish administration out of the country.
Plan backfired.
Yes, the plan absolutely backfired because this man that they thought was an innocent and unassuming man that we could control, all of a sudden, as soon as he gained power, decided that he hated the Spanish so much that he was going to kick them all out and just do with the country as he pleased, which is exactly what he did. So by March 1969, he started kicking all the Spanish out. He closed all their ports. With the Spanish leaving, obviously that meant that all the government agencies, all the judiciary functions, all the legislative functions, all the different institutions that were ran, as far as government institutions go, by the Spanish administration, were now in deficit because most of the people running this administration were now being kicked out. That also meant that the people running the church, the people running the hospitals, the schools, etc., were now being kicked out. And all that was going to remain in native hands. Again, like I say, it wasn't until almost 100 years before we granted independence that Spain started introducing some minimal education system inside Equatorial Guinea. It wasn't until about 15 to 10 years or so before we granted independence that people from Equatorial Guinea started going to Spain and other places to where there were universities and there were high schools and that kind of thing to acquire a formal education. So when you get independence in 68, or when we get independence in 68, and by the next year, all these people that have been running this administration and they've been running the schools and hospitals and everything are kicked out. What that means, you know, is that within a year after they're kicked out, all the schools, all the hospitals, and all the government agencies, except the military, are all closed because they cannot function. We did not have at that point the knowledge to run these administrations, to tax people, to get money and revenues, to keep the administration and all the functions of the government running. So the economy plummeted, and all the functions of the state except the military were gone, actually.
And so that's a time of terrible chaos, and there was a lot of brutality that went along with that.
Exactly. So as soon as that happened, you know, then when you have a situation of economic strife, you know, what that creates, you know, is a lot of unhappy people. People that cannot eat, people that do not have jobs, people that cannot go to the hospital, people whose kids do not go to hospital. So everything started spiraling out of control. Somewhat to control, or in his mind to control the chaos, he created not only his former military, but also a group of young militiamen who were supposed, in theory, to restore peace, to restore calm in society.
Now, when you say young, are you talking about child soldiers? I mean, very young?
Very, very young. I mean, very, very young, from the ages of 13, 14 up.
Yeah.
You know, and it was men, women, and it was compulsory. I mean, because again, you had all these kids; they were not going to schools, they were not going, they were not engaged in any formal education or anything, out in the streets committing crimes. And he used that group to repress everybody else. You know, so he used that group, formed his own private young or youth militia, and with that, you know, they started committing all sort of atrocities, horrible atrocities. I mean, within 11 years, Macias was president of Equatorial Guinea for 11 years, 1968 to 1979. Within that period, one-third of the population of Equatorial Guinea was either killed or forced out into exile in neighboring countries primarily, but also to Spain and other European countries. You know, and it was, again, due to that brutality, you know, having, seeing people killed in the streets, having military men coming to your house at night and killing your father and killing your mother and that kind of atrocious brutality, and having 150 people or so, you know, killed, executed on the soccer stadium, and crucifying people alongside the roads, and, you know, committing all sort of horrible atrocities, you know. And a lot of this crime, this killing, this massacre that was happening, you know, people were forced to come and witness and watch it, you know, which that instilled in a lot of people, you know, a fear that up until today, you know, still remains in most people's mind. You know, that really traumatized a lot of people.
And what, at this point, was the relationship like with Spain?
When Spain was kicked out of Equatorial Guinea in 69, they went back to Spain and, mad, upset about the situation that had just happened, they decided they were going to completely forget about Equatorial Guinea, you know. Spain at that point declared, because they were Equatorial Guineans, they had gone to university in Spain, they were still in Madrid and other places in Spain, and they were asking Spain, look, we need to replace this man. Spain, as soon as they left Equatorial Guinea, they declared all information about or on Equatorial Guinea, secret information, top secret information. Know, in Spanish, materia reservada. You know, so what that meant, you know, is that in Spain, a journalist, a lawyer, anyone could not discuss Equatorial Guinea because it was a top secret or an issue not to be discussed in Spain. People in Spain, Equatorial Guineans in Spain, they were trying to push for Spain to take an active role in taking out this dictator that they have put in place, were met with total ignorance, rejection. You know, so
what an irony! You are exiled from your country, and then the country that takes you in won't listen to what you're saying.
Yeah, exactly. You know, and that's again, you know, I think part of it, you know, is having miscalculated so much about placing Macias in power, and right now seeing again, you should also know that, you know, at that time Spain were also going through their own problems with Franco.
Right.
You know, so they had enough to deal with in the country, where they felt that, you know, they did not want to know anything, and they wanted to, as much as possible, just ignore Equatorial Guinea and its issues.
So what happened in 1979?
So, during that period of 68 to 79, where Macias was in power, all the intellectuals are killed. He places everyone from his clan, Macias again, is Fang, which is the majority group in Equatorial Guinea. And within the Fangs, you have several clans. One of the clans being the Esangi clan, which is from a city called Mongomo. He places all the people in his clan as the ministers and generals and chief of all the different positions in Equatorial Guinea. one of the people they were very, very highly placed in during the Macias regime was Teodoro Obiang-Nguema, who later on became president of Obiang. Teodoro Obiang-Nguema, during Macias regime, he had received some training, military training in Spain, Zaragoza. Then came back, and Macias, who is Teodoro's uncle, Obiang's uncle, made him the governor of Malabo, the capital city, made him the minister of defense, and also made him the chief of prisons. And with being the chief of prisons and minister of defense, what that meant is that he controlled the army, and he controlled the jails, and he was overseeing a lot of the killing, a lot of the torturing, and a lot of the massacres that happened during the first 11 years. Economically, you know, the country was suffering. And people like Teodoro Obiang-Nguema, the nephew, and others saw that, look, maybe there is an opportunity for us here to get rid of this guy, of Macias, get relationship going on again with Spain and other European countries, as well as international financial institutions, they will be willing to support our cause, you know? And that's what they did. So from the inside, Obiang started contacting Spain, Obiang and others, started contacting Spain and other countries and seeking support to get rid of Macias, primarily, again, because of the economic conditions. In 79, after fighting almost a war in the continental side, they eventually captured Macias. He was brought to Malabo, the capital city, where after a mock trial, pretty much, he was executed the next day. You know, after he was executed, Obiang initially formed what he called a military council to rule Equatorial Guinea until it was decided who was going to be president. 3 months later, he named himself as the president-elect to replace his uncle. So, again, a coup d'etat, which ends up with Macias not being tried and all information about his regime not coming out. Instead, him being killed the same day that he's arrested, and Obiang instituting himself as the next leader.
And meanwhile, he's the person who'd been the director of the military and the director of prisons, had overseen torture, so you're going from one dictator essentially to another.
Exactly. And not only that, because he was from the same clan, once he takes over from his uncle, all the people that his uncle has in his administration, in his cabinet, are people that up until today, most of them, those that have not died, are still in position of power, are still the ministers of defense, ministers of national security, etc., etc. You know, Obiang, in many ways, continue all the repressive tactics that his uncle used during the first 11 years. Certainly, to his credit, he was able to reopen schools, the church was reopened, hospitals were reopened, even though they are minimally functioning today. But the truth is, repression against independent media, repression against lawyers and teachers and people to speak freely, still continues today. People do not have the ability to speak freely. People do not have the ability to think or write or do anything that, you know, in a free society people should have. The judiciary is still absolutely controlled, because he came back and reinstituted the institution of the judiciary and the legislative system, but they're still very much controlled, absolutely controlled by Obiang himself.
Who's been there from 1979 until the present.
Exactly.
Now, was there any economic improvement at all? Was there trade? Was there, what was the economy based on at that time?
So, when Obiang comes to power, he then started relationships again with Spain and with other European nations. The World Bank then decides to invest in Equatorial Guinea. The IMF decides to reopen trade negotiations with Equatorial Guinea. So, initially, or they thought that, you know, look, the way to revive something in Equatorial Guinea is to go back to agriculture, cocoa and coffee. However, all the money that was invested by European nations and World Bank, IMF and others into cocoa, production, into coffee production and all agricultural products, were all swindled by the government and all these people. One of the things the Macias regime also instituted and Obiang continued was a deeply entrenched corruption, you know, because there was no formal economy, really. People in the military and people in position of power live by corruption, live by bribes, and it was the only way the system functioned at that point. Obiang came, you know, and that continued, you know, from the highest position of power, Obiang, his family himself, you know, they started embezzling a lot of the money that was destined to agriculture, to promoting agriculture, to promoting fishing industry, to promoting other industries. So the economy, which was supposed to be based initially in agriculture, you know, was failing. Obiang at one point decides we're going to switch our currency from pesetas, which is what we were using, pesetas, backed by the pesetas españolas at that point, Spanish currency at that point. He decides he's going to switch from pesetas and join the Franco zone. That was the zone, the African zone, using the franc CFA, which was backed by the French francs. He does that, and to some extent, and, you know, the economy picked up a little bit, because now Cameroon, Gabon, and other countries were able to trade with Equatorial Guinea, something that hadn't happened up until that point. So the economy picked up a little bit, but still, because of the entrenched level of corruption, it wasn't an economy that functioned properly, you know? And it wasn't really until, I mean, because Equatorial Guinea, for all intents and purposes, was one of the poorest nations in Africa up until the mid-90s when oil was discovered.
Well, let's talk about that now, the discovery of oil. That was one of those things that, by the way, we're talking to Tutu Alicante, who is a visiting research associate at the School for Advanced Research here in Santa Fe. The discovery of resources that are such as oil can be a blessing to a country, or they can be a curse, as we've seen in many places.
Yes.
Who discovered oil? When did it happen? What happened next?
Yes. Yeah, like you say, I would like to reiterate what you just say about, you know, oil and natural resources in general. Having that double intent of sometimes being a blessing and sometimes being an absolute curse. You know, and in our case, you know, it has been a curse. So far, at least. Oil was initially, in the 70s, Equatorial Guinea thought there was oil in Equatorial Guinea because there was so much oil in Nigeria, there was so much oil in Angola, in all the neighboring countries, even Gabon. So we, at that point, had contact with Spain, you know, and had the Spanish oil company, Cepsa, do some prospections. Their geological work did not turn out anything. So we thought we had oil, but because of the technology that Spain had available to its oil companies at that point, we didn't discover anything. Then in the mid-1990s, the Obiang regime contacted American companies. There was a small oil company in Houston that was contacted to come and do some prospections. Within a year or so of doing their geological studies and everything, they came up to the conclusion that, you know, there was a lot of oil in Equatorial Guinea. At that point, ExxonMobil primarily was contacted about the possibility of coming to Equatorial Guinea and engaging with the government in some contracts to search for oil, to go and explore, and if there was any oil, produce the oil. Exxon came and immediately, within a year or so, hit several oil wells, you know. Within 2 years of being in Equatorial Guinea, Exxon was producing almost 200,000 to 300,000 barrels of oil a day. You know?
And meanwhile, the contracts that had been written with the government really favored ExxonMobil at the expense of the government of Equatorial Guinea.
Yes, I mean, what happened, you know, when ExxonMobil came and then they invited Mareda Hess and Chevron Texaco and Marathon and others, they came to a situation in Equatorial Guinea where there were no trained oil economies. There were not trained in cable lawyers, they were not trained in cable geologists and other people to go out there as equal partners with all these high power lawyers, economists, and geologists coming from Houston and look at the oil wells and look at the possibilities and strike equitable contracts, you know. So what happened, you know, they came with all these people and took advantage of the situation and wrote some contracts that absolutely benefited the oil companies, you know, to the detriment of Equatorial Guinean government, which for the Equatorial Guinean government was not a bad deal because they were coming from a situation of having absolutely no money to assure the situation where now the president, his family, and a few others in his entourage were going to be controlling a lot of money. You know, because, mind you, within 2-3 years of being there, there was a lot of oil being produced in the country. And even at that point, it was about 10% royalties that Equatorial Guinea was receiving. Even a 10% of what was discovered was enough money to make the president and his family millionaires overnight.
And that money could have done tremendous benefit to the country, who and the people were living very poorly and still are. But instead, there were a lot of mansions built and bought, both here, both in Equatorial Guinea and in the United States, and the money has just stayed in the hands of a very few people.
Yes, it's a weird thing, you know. You go to Equatorial Guinea today, you know. I was in Equatorial Guinea about 3 to 4 years ago, my last time I was there. And from the Equatorial Guinea I left to the Equatorial Guinea that we have today, where you have huge mansions.
Now, when did you leave?
I left Equatorial Guinea in 1994.
Okay.
To come to the U.S. to study. But again, so in 2004, when I go back to when last time I was in Equatorial Guinea, one of the things that you see, you know, is you see all these huge mansions, you know, and huge buildings. And when you start asking, you know, who does that building belong to, or who... And it all goes back to President Obiang, or it all goes back to his wife, or one of his sons, or one of his brothers. You know, and this is not only in the capital city; this is also in the continental region. When you look at the land ownership, you know, all the land that's now owned and operated, you know, where they have built their plants and stuff, by all companies have built their plants and that kind of stuff. Which used to belong to private individuals where they had their own cocoa plantations and cocoa farms, now all are in the hands of the oil companies, but only because Obiang and his family took that land from the rightful owners, expropriated the land, and then leased it or sold it to the oil companies, you know. To a large extent, or absolutely, in absolute terms, the oil production, the oil revenues in Equatorial Guinea has not meant absolutely any benefit to the majority of the people. Today, most people in Equatorial Guinea are still living on less than $1 a day, you know, on $1 a day, basically. You know, and that's at least 75% of the population, and these are the figures from the World Bank, IMF, and others, you know. What that means in a place like Equatorial Guinea with so that much oil, you know, is that most people cannot live, because what oil does to an economy, you know, is that all the prices, you know, skyrocket as soon as you discover oil. So traveling into the country, living in a country in a hotel, getting access to any of the basic necessities, you know, water, electricity, or anything, is really a challenge. You know, so most people in Equatorial Guinea today, despite the fact that at this point we're producing, or Equatorial Guinea is producing, about 500,000 barrels of oil, most of the people in Equatorial Guinea still do not have running water. Most of the people in Equatorial Guinea still do not have electricity. The health conditions and the education conditions are still deplorable.
What has been the relationship between Washington and Equatorial Guinea?
To give you a short history, up until about 94, there used to be a U.S. embassy in Equatorial Guinea. The ambassador at that point received a lot of death threats from the regime because he was trying to engage in all the issues they were, the people in society was facing, you know, not necessarily engaging in politics, but trying to help to open up something, open up independent media, help political parties survive in opposition political parties, because at that point, Obiang was under a lot of pressure to create a democratic system with multi-parties, with several opposition parties. And with this ambassador being there and trying to promote that political space for the people and independent institutions to function, he started receiving death threats, and the situation got bad enough to where U.S. realized, well, we do not have any, and this is again in 94, we do not have any economic state or stake in this place. What keeps us from getting out? So the U.S. closed its embassy and left. Now, a few years later, 1996, ExxonMobil begins to produce oil. And at that point, ExxonMobil, with all its employees having to travel back and forth, where them having to bring people from other countries to travel there, and just the business deals and everything, they started lobbying the U.S. government to reopen the embassy in Equatorial Guinea. Eventually, the U.S. government reopens the embassy in Equatorial Guinea, and for several years, the ExxonMobil compound was also the house for the U.S. embassy. The U.S. embassy was housed in one of the offices of the ExxonMobil compound. You know, and what that shows, you know, is the connection between U.S. foreign policy and oil in a place like Equatorial Guinea.
Yeah, not too subtle.
Exactly. Recently, in 2006, 2007, the U.S. decided to move its embassy from the ExxonMobil compound and get a building. They do get a building, you know, but we find out later on that this building belongs to one of the non-human rights violators in Equatorial Guinea, who is also the Minister of Defense, I believe, right now. And in one of the questions that was presented to the now ambassador of the U.S. in Equatorial Guinea, one of the questions asked him, how is it that the U.S. is willing to house the embassy in Equatorial Guinea in a building that belongs to a non-human rights violator that Amnesty International and other organizations have documented violation and killing and torture committed by these men? You know, aren't we really propping up a dictatorial regime? Aren't we allowing these people, you know, to actually monopolize everything? And the response that we got from the office of the ambassador was that actually, when you look at Equatorial Guinea, all the buildings that would be suitable for U.S. embassy and for the purposes that the U.S. would need the embassy for belong to some powerful member of the regime, so you can't get away from that, you know. And again, you know what that tells me, an untrained foreign policy person, is that the U.S. is to an extent willing to do whatever if there is oil in that country, and if it's important for us to get that access to that oil.
Now, there was in Washington a Senate investigation into some of these issues of corruption on the part of the government and its relationship with the oil company. Tell us about this and what came of it.
Okay, so they found out about Equatorial Guinea and Riksbank in a strange way, because initially, you know, the purpose was to investigate Pinochet and other people.
Riggs Bank being a bank in Washington, D.C.
Yes, this was one of the biggest banks in Washington, D.C., and biggest because it did the business with mostly foreign officials, with powerful people in Saudi Arabia, with a lot of government officials of several different countries, and embassies, a lot of the embassies in Washington, D.C., up until that point, because after the investigation, the Riggs Bank were forced to close. So, before that, you know, they did business with most of the big institutions, foreign institutions in that area. So the Senate subcommittee on investigations decided to investigate Riggs because they feared there were allegations of embezzlement by other governments. In the process of investigating and looking at Chile and other places, they find out that there were about $700 million in the name of the Equatorial Guinea government or specific people within the Equatorial Guinean government. And what was happening, you know, it was that as a result of the contract that was signed between all companies and the government of Equatorial Guinea, monies were being deposited in at the Riggs banks in an account that that seemed to be a legitimate state account for Equatorial Guinea, state treasury. But then once it got there, people that they have at the bank were transferring some monies to private accounts to on the names of Obiang, his wife, his sons, etc., etc. Private accounts to which only President Obiang and one of his sons had the authorization to transfer monies from. So it was very clear to the investigators at that point that monies were going into rigs and then being channeled through in undisclosed means to other private accounts, either within rigs or to other places in Bahamas and Monaco and other places.
And meanwhile, Obiang's son paid cash for a $2.6 million mansion in Washington, D.C.
Yeah, well, actually, that was Obiang's home himself. You know, Obiang has two mansions very close to Washington, D.C. This is in Potomac, Maryland, very close to Washington, D.C. Obiang's brother owns a very luxurious apartment in Virginia. Obiang's son, however, owns, and this is his eldest son, Teodoro, also known as Teodoro, but Teodoro Ngema, myself, Teodoro Obiang, owns two multi-million dollar mansions in South Africa. Very recently, about a year and a half ago, he purchased a $35 million estate in Malibu, California. He owns a fleet of luxurious and expensive cars all over the world, wherever he travels to. And again, they own private planes. And, you know, so certainly they are not living as the rest of Equatorial Guineans are living. They are not living the life of a poor.
Well, and it's so terribly sad because that money could do so much to actually help the people of Equatorial Guinea. What's the opposition like? Is there an opposition? There's been tremendous repression of any political opposition.
Yes. So, you know, at one point, Spain and other countries pushed Obiang, and this was, again, before oil was discovered, pushed Obiang to accept a multi-party system. They conditioned his acceptance of a multi-party system on continuing aid. You know, at that point, Obiang initially allowed people in opposition who until that point had been staying outside the country to come back and campaign and see what was going to happen. After the campaigns, Obiang saw that his popularity, for lack of a better word, you know, his grip, his hold on the government was eroding. So what he did, you know, he imprisoned most of the political opposition political leaders that came to Equatorial Guinea. Most of them had to spend a lot of years in prison before they were allowed to leave the country. After that initial period, and it was in the late 80s, most opposition political leaders went back to Spain, and they have remained in Spain. So right now, you look at opposition politics in Spain, and you have several, you know, about 14 political opposition groups, most of whom do not really have a constituency inside the country, and most of whom even lack a constituency outside the country. You know, it's just, at times, even, you know, it's just one person and four or five friends who decides that he would make a good president for Equatorial Guinea and starts using whatever means at his disposal, whether it's media in Spain, whether it's just a website, to propagate or promulgate himself as the next elected leader for Obiang. You know, in my mind, you know, political opposition groups today, you know, have an approach that I think is not the one that we need in Equatorial Guinea. I mean, I think in Equatorial Guinea we need more of a social reform rather than a political reform.
Tell us, say more about that.
Well, what I mean by that, you know, political reform, you know, relies on having a political opposition leader or some political figure wanting to go out there and change the current government and become the next president and either do the same exact things that Obiang is doing now, or allow some room, but certainly not deal with the underlying problems that the country has. You know, in my mind, you know, social reform or social revolution, or however we want to call it, is something that comes from the ordinary people. You know, is something that pushes for changing the way people live. You know, and that comes from initially changing the way people think. And none of these political opposition leaders are out there, you know, trying to articulate a vision of Equatorial Guinea that most people would embrace, you know, and that's absolutely essential, you know. And for me, you know, the social revolution that we need is one that have to come from the people. The people, and sometimes you might need a catalyst, you know, you might need community leaders that can go out there and articulate the vision of Equatorial Guinea that we need, the vision of Equatorial Guinea that's open, that is democratic, that is just, and that encompasses all the ethnic groups and all the people living in that Equatorial Guinea. Once you articulate that vision, then you get people, you know, to start changing the way we live, you know, start addressing issues of corruption, start addressing all these other issues. They are going to help us live in a better Equatorial Guinea. And that's what we need primarily, and that's what's not happening.
We're talking to Tutu Alicante. What is the nature of your work on Equatorial Guinea that you are doing outside the country?
All right. So before I talk about the nature of my work, you know, I think it's important for me to talk about why it is or how it is that I came to be here today right now. Again, I've talked about the violence in Equatorial Guinea during the Maciel regime, a violence that continued during the Obiang regime. In 1993, again, I'm from Manobon, one of the smallest islands in the southern hemisphere. In 1993, one of the worst things happened in Manobon, in my village. There was a revolt, a young group of people, they were tired about all the injustices they face. You know, again, Manobon is about 360 nautical miles from the rest of Equatorial Guinea, the capital in the continental side. And this is a country that, and this is an island, pardon me, that for several years, the only contact they had with the outside world was when a boat traveled there once a year and at times once every other year with the most basic things that you can think of, you know, salt, matches, oil, kerosene for the lamps, etc., etc. So it was completely isolated, you know. There is a small building over there that's supposed to function as a hospital, but there is absolutely nothing in that hospital. There are two beds, and, you know, most of the time they go out without antibiotics, without aspirins, without the most basic things that you think. You know, the school is the same exact situation. So a group of young people in 1993 decided, you know, look, we cannot continue to live under these conditions. We want change. And went to the governor, who was a Fang, because that's another thing, that, you know, even though people in Manobon are from an ethnic group, from the local ethnic group, most of the people in the military, most of the people in the governor, the mayor, etc., are all Fang people. They're there to control the masses, you know. So they went to the governor to face, to voice their demands, and within a day, the administration in the capital city, Obiang, sent an army, a boatload full of military men, armed to their teeth, to come and put down this young group of people. They arrived, and on that same day, you know, started arresting all the men between 15 and 30 years old. All these men were all tortured and beaten severely, you know.
They had anything to do with it or not.
Whether they had anything to do with it at all, you know. I still go to this day, I still go to Spain and other places and run into people that have been so badly beaten that they're still undergoing medical treatment in Spain, obviously. But anyway, so one of the things that happened also, you know, is that they burned down all the houses. They killed, I think it was two of the young men, you know, at a very close range, shot them to death. Burned down several houses, including my father's home, you know. And again, I remember, you know, that day, you know, when my father came home and I asked him, you know, what he was going to do. And his response to me was that there was nothing we could do. We had to rebuild. Then at that point, I decided, you know, there had to be something, human beings, citizens of a country can do to change or to address these injustices. You know, I refuse to believe that, you know, living in a country where 1% of the people control and manipulate everybody, there was nothing we can do, you know. So eventually, you know, I came to the U.S. To study journalism, to write about the conditions of my country. But one thing led to another, and I became a lawyer and eventually a human rights lawyer. And I started looking, or I started seeing how I can use my legal education, my education as a lawyer trained in the U.S., the contacts I've made in the U.S., to try to change the situation in my country. And that's how I came to form or to establish the organization called EG Justice.
And so we have only just about a minute left. What would increased public opinion in the United States, increased knowledge about Equatorial Guinea in this country, do to help your country?
A lot, you know. First of all, you know, like I mentioned earlier, two-thirds of all the oil companies operating in Equatorial Guinea are American companies. Two-thirds of the oil produced in Equatorial Guinea comes to the United States. You know?
There used to be, or maybe still is, a direct flight from Houston to Equatorial Guinea.
There is still a direct flight, which is only for the purposes of taking oil people to Equatorial Guinea.
Right.
And it seems to me that, you know, the U.S. Realizes or should realize that operating in a place like Equatorial Guinea, they're propping up a dictator. You know, you cannot continue to funnel that money into a government where, I mean, if you look at this room, if most of us were born in Equatorial Guinea, the majority of us would be dead because of the death rate, because of the human development indexes in Equatorial Guinea. You know, the majority of us would have died at childbirth or before we attained the age of 5. And that condition exists today despite the billions and billions of dollars that the U.S. is investing in that country. So increasing public opinion here in the U.S. and engaging Congress in taking steps to curb corruption in a place like Equatorial Guinea would do a lot, because that would guarantee that, you know, monies that are supposed to go to addressing health, education, and other social welfare issues go to address those issues rather than going to buy mansions in the United States and other places.
Tutu Alicante, I'd like to thank you so much for being with us here on the Santa Fe Radio Cafe.
It's my pleasure. Thank you. And I would like to recognize, I don't know if we have time, but I would like to recognize the School for Advanced Research for all it has done to help me come to Santa Fe and build my organization. You know, it's been a wonderful opportunity. And for those of you that don't know what the school is, you should definitely visit it. And that's on Garcia Street, 660, I believe.
And is there a website for your organization?
It's going to be egjustice.org, and that's coming up in about 2 weeks. It should be up. So it's something up already, but just skeletal, so I'm still trying to build it.
And we'll put that on our website. Tutu Alicante is visiting research associate at the School for Advanced Research here in Santa Fe, and he's a human rights attorney from Equatorial Guinea and is affiliated with the Southern Migrant Law Center and Columbia University's Project for Human Rights in Africa and the Americas. You've been listening to the Santa Fe Radio Cafe. My name is Mary Charlotte. KSFR streams live on the web at ksfr.org. You can reach me at radiocafe@ksfr.org or leave a message at 428-1528. We're also podcasting. The website is santafe.radiocafe.org, where you can hear the show anytime you want, thanks to Santa Fe's .foil computer services, and you can also subscribe to the show on iTunes. Thanks to Marilyn LeBlanc for engineering today. Stay tuned for the BBC, followed by local news by KSFR's award-winning news team, and after that, The Colors of Jazz. Broadcasting live from the Santa Fe Baking Company, my name is Mary Charlotte. Hasta mañana. Ciao.